The Heart of Danger by Michael D. Cooper, Part 1, Under the Red Sun. Chapter 12, Minor Advances. A few days after Derf Bors and his crew had driven off the Xenobut menace from the sun, Richard Starlight saw to it that the level of vigilance on the outer planets would be increased to maximum. He directed the settlements on Ganymede and Titan, being closest to the two innermost gas giant planets, to unceasing surveillance of Uranus, Neptune, Pluto, and Nix, with the entire bank of technology available to them. Further, he directed Elijah Base on Titan to launch a set of probes to each of the four planets. Capsules would streak to the planets and, once in close proximity, disgorge many hundreds of microprobes that would swarm around the planet and their moons. These probes would report any unusual gravitational disturbances, wormhole activity, or real-time transmissions that may occur. Even the planetoids were included in the watch. Quaoar and similar bodies in orbit around the sun in the distant reaches of the solar system were likewise kept under observation. In spite of these measures, the forces of civilization were painfully aware that these precautions, intense as they were woefully incomplete. Comets could easily slip through such a net, and nothing could prevent the Xenobots from entering the solar system in empty space without landing on any natural body. They could build an artificial base far from any planet, moon, planetoid, or comet, and might go undetected for months before the far-flung gravitational detectors noted anything out of the ordinary. The outer planetary space was just too large, unpredictable, and in many places even unexplored for any close watch to be fail-safe. After giving the orders to the Starlight bases beyond Mars, Richard turned to a report that had come in from Mars Base, SE's major presence on the fourth planet. Starman Joe Taylor had piloted a Xenobot spacecraft from wherever it was that he and Mark had been held captive the previous summer. He had taken it through hyperspace to a crash landing on Mars. After a preliminary inspection in the largest hangars Mars Base could provide, Mika Watanabe, the head of security at Starlight Mars, had ordered that the craft be taken into orbit far from any inhabited portion of the planet. A painstaking scrutiny was then initiated. The progress report, at least, was somewhat encouraging, Richard read. The disassembly and analysis of the Xenobot fighter is proving to be of value. We have discovered that the fighter maintains a steady link to a solar power station over a tachyon band. When necessary, its internal power center draws more fuel from the power station. During the process, the fighter must cease all other operations, and a very thin wormhole connection is established between the fighter and its power station. A stream of antimatter is sent over this connection and acts as fuel for the craft. The engineers and physicists at Mars Base were fully aware of the limitations of their analysis and the unresolved questions associated with it. The solar power drive itself had been removed from the Xenobot ship. Since it had been provided as a decoy for the captive starmen, nothing of value that was unnecessary to the Xenobot's ruse had been left aboard the ship. However, the connections for the absent apparatus were in place, and from these the SE scientists were drawing their conclusions. The connections for magnetic bottles and a wormhole creator specific to the solar power center were in place, even if the actual apparatus was missing. Still a puzzle was the issue that Mika Watanabe had asked within hours of the ship's arrival near her base. Whoever was in charge of the Starman's abduction was hoping that they would do precisely what they had done, return to their own solar system with the captive ship. That insight raised questions. Why would they do that? Was there something on the ship that shouldn't have been brought to Mars? True, the ploy was designed to cause the Starmen to lead their abductors to the Amanians, and the ploy had nearly succeeded. Was there no more to the empty spacecraft than that, or was there some farther sinister complication to the enigma? Those questions had been unanswerable at the time Joe had landed the spacecraft, and more than a year later the analysts and examiners of the Xenobot ship were apparently no closer to a solution. Dr. Hoshino's main office was at Starlight Enterprise, Hawaii, in a tightly packed complex huddled at the foot of Mauna Loa. A cluster of one- and two-story buildings, white and gray edifices with large plate-glass windows, nestled on the north side of the immense volcano. Palm trees more than 60 feet high waved in the mild breeze. While the renowned scientist was on Tharsos, his other research responsibilities had fallen to his second-in-command, Dr. Andor Venato. Dr. Venato was a tall man with dark curly hair and smooth olive skin. He was eminently trustworthy and fully dedicated to his work, but a little overconfident. The man gazed intently at a screen examining the reactions in subatomic particles to various stimuli when he became acutely aware of a heavy presence. The janitor suddenly appeared in his laboratory, leaving the unusually imperturbable physicist stunned. "Dr. Vornado," said the janitor. "Dr. Hoshino is occupied with a mission in Omega Centauri. Therefore, I have come to inform you of the successful results of my examination of the Lucian crystals." Without further preliminary remarks, the janitor began his explanation. After some time, he concluded, "So you see, Dr. Vornado, the information in these crystals can make it possible for you to extend your defensive capabilities greatly, thereby reducing the immediacy of the Xenobot threat." The tall physicist nodded vigorously. "It is magnificent. Even from your brief description, I can see that there is much in the crystals that I can absorb in the short time available to us, but I understand the principles of what we need to do now. But it will take a lifetime, several lifetimes, to extract and master the data the crystals contain." "I regret I am unable to help you more," said the janitor, "but my own knowledge of these matters is limited." "If you can find the information and translate it for me," responded Dr. Venato confidently, "I think I will be able to apply it. When Dr. Hoshino returns, our work will go faster." "For a young race," said the janitor, "you have impressive capability. You've come far in a short time." "Indeed," said Dr. Venato, nodding his head in simple acknowledgment of the fact. "Will the Amanians be able to assist us in building the apparatus we will need?" "They will. Your collaboration must begin immediately, and perhaps should include Dr. Hoshino by real-time transmission." The janitor vanished. Dr. Vornado strode out of the laboratory to the communications center. "Cosmic energy? Seriously?" asked Stephen Hoshino by real-time transmission from Tharsis, somewhere in the outskirts of Omega Centauri. "Most assuredly, Dr. Hoshino," affirmed Terugi, speaking from his laboratory on Amania. "The janitor, with the help of the Griegels, was able to provide for us the names of the data files inside the crystals. There are many thousands, perhaps tens of thousands of these files, but they are categorized by subject from the least specific to most. Many titles are intriguing, but once it became clear that they could not help us in our present need, we passed them by and investigated others. There are many files that even the janitor could not understand. It was a wearing task, since we did not have the capability to do an automated search. It took more than 3 weeks of painstaking exploration to locate and read the files on cosmic energy, and realize that this information could prove of immediate application. With it, we can construct a shield against wormhole intrusion that will cover the entire solar system." Dr. Andor Vornado joined in from his office on Hawaii. "The Amanians understand the necessary subatomic principles clearly. Steve and the janitor explained them to me as well. Believe me, it is demanding all my self-discipline not to take this new knowledge and proceed directly to research rather than get to work building the equipment we'll need to establish a defense of the solar system." "Energy from the quantum froth," mused Dr. Hoshino aloud to no one in particular. Awe ran through his voice. He had an image of a frothing sea of churning foam made of subatomic particles that appear and vanish in microseconds in the supposed vacuum of space. Devising a theory on how to harness the quantum froth to produce energy, much less the hardware to turn theory into accomplished fact, was so far beyond even his own speculation that he was dazed. Why, we could have a staggering amount of energy at our fingertips, virtually unlimited, far more than the stellar energy, since it would not diminish with distance from a star. The noted scientist grounded himself. How long will it be until you can have a prototype constructed? A matter of weeks, Steve, said Andor. We can perhaps have a small prototype ready in 10 days or so to prove that it will work and to discover any areas of endeavor that will need fine-tuning. After that, if all goes well, I suppose it won't be too long before we'll be able to shield the entire solar system. Amazing, just amazing, said Dr. Hoshino.